That's fine.
That first one.
Okay, I think
that's
much better.
Fine.
So, I guess we can get started. It's my pleasure to introduce Simon White, who's visiting us from Max Planck Institute in Garching, Germany. So, Simon, now I was just assigned the responsibility to introduce Simon, so I cannot say everything that Simon has won over the time from the memory, but a lot of the astronomy and cosmology that we know over the past couple of decades was invented by Simon. And in fact, dark matter is Simon's middle name, in case you didn't know. So he was very humbly admitted that, but we all know. So without further ado, I'll give you Simon. But he, by the way, he gives the colloquium tomorrow, and you're all welcome to come to the colloquium as well. Today and tomorrow, so he leaves tomorrow at 4.
Okay, so I'm not quite sure what the audience is here. So how many people here would think of themselves as astronomers? Okay. How many people would think of themselves as astroparticle physicists? How many people think of themselves as cosmologists? Okay, there's still some more, right? Okay, well, we'll see. We'll see how he goes.
You might get more if you ask. Add the word "developing."
Ah, okay. Oh, fine. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is how we can model the formation and evolution of the galaxy population as a whole inside our current standard structure formation model. So I think observationally, the structure formation model is no longer based on rotation curves of galaxies and things like this. It's actually based on more solid ground. And we have quantitative demonstrations of its consistency at a variety of times, the epoch of recombination, when we see the structure in the microwave background, which we now can characterize really quite precisely, the redshift of 2 or 3, where we see structure in the intergalactic gas between the galaxies. These are absorption lines in quasars. So what you're seeing is the absorption by neutral hydrogen in the intergalactic medium between the quasar and us has all this structure, which is what's producing the variability of the transmission that causes the absorption lines. You can characterize this. This then is measuring the structure before the galaxy is formed in the intergalactic medium. And we can see the galaxy distribution, here half of the 2DF sky survey, the large-scale structure in the galaxy distribution. So from all these ways, we can quantify our model. And our standard model produces the linear initial conditions that we see directly in the microwave background, produces the IGM structure before and during galaxy formation, we also see directly, and it produces the large-scale structure we see today. And there are additional things like gravitational lensing observations, which give us fairly direct measurements of the matter distribution on relatively large scales, which are also there. So inside this standard model, of course, one of the things it tells us is the geometry of the universe and its contents. In particular, as you know, that the geometry is flat. Most of the universe today is apparently dark energy. Of the quarter that is matter, 5/6 of that or so is apparently non-baryonic, and only a sixth, or about 4% of the total energy density, appears to be baryons. So in the dominant gravitating component, or cluster component, the dark matter, the standard model tells us what it's made of and what the initial conditions are, and that at least for the dark matter, only gravity has significant effects. So therefore, we can actually calculate, using standard numerical techniques, fairly precise predictions for what the model predicts today. And then we want to try and test those, of course. In particular, it predicts the properties of the dark matter structures, like their abundance as a function of their mass, for example, their internal structure, whether they're spherical, triaxial, how much internal structure, how well relaxed they are, how they're put together, so how a particular object today was assembled, how they're moving in space, how and when they merge each other. So those are really quite precise predictions. You can't do this analytically, but the theory is simple enough, and the initial conditions are fully specified, so you can derive them computationally. and get quite precise properties for the nonlinear dark matter objects, which are what we call dark matter halos. So, of course, we don't see dark matter halos directly, at best through gravitational lensing. What we see are the galaxies. So then if we want to address the properties of the galaxies, we have to ask ourselves, how do the galaxies form and evolve within this framework? We want to do this both because we're interested in how galaxies form and evolve, but also because we would like to use this to see if we can find ways to test the framework itself. So you want to use the galaxy population in two ways. The observations, you want to put this framework together with the observations to understand galaxies as objects, how they're going to be the way we see them. And then we want to ask, can we use the properties of the galaxies and the fact we can get many observational evidence from many directions, can we use this to actually test the framework? So observations of galaxies have become quite precise, or at least the galaxy population. So here's an example. This is just the abundance of galaxies, their number per unit volume, as a function of their mass in stars. So the horizontal axis is the stellar mass, from 10 to the 12 times the mass of the Sun to 10 to the 8 times the mass of the Sun. So the Milky Way is about 5 times 10 to the 10. It's here somewhere. So this is based on the Sloan Digital Sky Survey final data release, which is about 500,000 galaxies selected in a way which is well understood, all of which have excellent photometry and have distances from their redshifts. The stellar masses, unfortunately, are not so easy to get. There's a systematic uncertainty there, but at least you can minimize the effects on this plot by measuring stellar masses for all the galaxies in the same way, which is what has been done. So the error bars you see now are basically counting statistics and the effects of large-scale structure. So they're everything except the systematics in deriving the stellar mass from the photometry. And what you see is the error bars are really small, and that's because they have a lot of objects. So they're really small over a very wide range in mass. We have four orders of magnitude in mass here. So if we know how many galaxies are up unit volume as a function of their mass in stars, the simplest thing you can do is just integrate this function to find the total mass in stars. That sort gives you this number, this estimated error. So every cubic megaparsec has about 3 times 10 to the 8 solar masses in stars. This already gives you a significant and perhaps surprising result, because this is the total mass per unit volume in stars. But we know in our standard cosmology what the total mass per unit volume in baryons is, and it's 30 times higher. So if our model is correct, only 3%, 3.5% of all the baryons are in stars. All the rest is in something else. So this tells you whatever the process was that made galaxies apparently was extremely inefficient. By the present day, only 3% of the baryons will be made into stars. That's already, just this level, quite a significant conclusion.
So can I ask this question? So if you were to guess, what fraction of the baryons would you think, or the baryons that are not in the stars, do you think are ionized? Do you think all of them, or like?
They almost all have to be ionized, otherwise you would be able to see them in absorption against other objects.
So the neutral fraction, would it be comparable to this?
Or? Well, the neutral fraction today is smaller than this by about a factor of 10, and it's mostly in neutral gas inside galaxies. The neutral gas between galaxies is even lower, which you can measure by absorption towards.
So essentially everything else is ionized?
Yes. Presumably, assuming it's there. Mm. We haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So you're assuming the model is right. Always very dangerous. Okay, but anyway, if the model is right, there's 30 times more stuff we have to find. And the galaxy formation is now. So you can also get, a significant conclusion just by looking at where the stars are. So if you take this mass function, you can plot the same, this is exactly the same plot, just recast. So you imagine taking a large volume of the universe, you take every single star in that volume, and you say, what's the mass of the galaxy I live in? And they say, oh, it's the Milky Way, it's 5 times 10 to the 10. So I put the star here. And I go to the next star, and it's in a lower mass galaxy, and I put it here. So this is histogramming the entire mass of stars in the universe today, according to the mass of the galaxy that they live in. And it looks really narrow, but that's because this is 10 to the 16, and this is 10 to the 4. And so I put 12 orders of magnitude along the horizontal axis. So when you do it like this, you see that stars really like to live in galaxies of this mass. And there's a very well-defined mass of a galaxy, which is actually a bit less than the mass of the Milky Way. So our star lives in a typical galaxy, or it's a typical star, if you like. Okay. So, right, so it looks like. The point, though, is that this curve is extremely different if you ask, where does a typical dark matter particle live? Daniel. So the typical star in the universe lives in an object of very well-defined mass. Now let's ask, in our standard model, where does a typical dark matter particle mass live? So you do exactly the same thing. You take a representative volume of space, you pick a random dark matter particle, and you say, oh, I live in a dark matter object of mass 10 to the 12, I'll put myself here. 10 to the 6, I put it here. You make the same curve. Looks like this. It's not at all the same shape. There's a very long tail. There's another 20 or 30% off to the left here. The peak is not in the same place. And the width is quite different.
You didn't put in the errors in this.
There's no error bar.
The error bars are essentially zero in this.
By the way,
yeah.
The 10 to the 4 solar mass.
Well, you saw the error bar. The observational error bars were the ones I showed in this plot, right?
Uh-huh.
So you can see the negligible for the with the Scott laws of magnitude. And for the dark matter, that's theory, so no error bars on there.
You can't have any errors.
Sorry?
You don't have any errors.
You can have errors, but no error bars.
You don't see it.
Sorry.
So you should grab it.
Theorists have errors and they have bars, but they don't mix them. okay. So what you see is these curves really look different. So this tells you there has to be a reason why stars like to be here. Because after all, we think that the baryons were initially distributed like the dark matter because they were both uniform, basically. And since recombination, when the pressure in the baryons was zero, the baryons effectively follow the dark matter to dark matter clusters. So if you made the plot for where the baryons were in the universe, you would actually expect to get a curve which looks like this black one. So the baryon distribution is probably similar to the black curve, would be in the standard model, but the stars are not. So that tells you that the stars are formed in very special places.
So how is the black curve formed again? You take a typical dark matter particle with a certain volume.
And I find that dark matter halo, nonlinear object that sits in.
Inferred by?
From a simulation.
From simulation.
You have to do a simulation to do that. You can't derive that in, well, to do it this accurately, you need to do a high precision simulation. And obviously you have to have a definition of what you mean by an object.
Well, that's what I was wondering, is how is an object?
Basically, an object is defined to be the, you know, if you do a simulation, you really do see objects. But they kind of merge smoothly into the background. So there's some ambiguity about where you should put the edge. So you typically put the edge at a place where the typical orbital period is equal to the edge of the universe, because that's effectively the bounds, the equilibrium region.
So in galaxies, light traces matter on the Tully Fisher rule. So how does the dark matter know how to do this?
The Tully Fisher law doesn't tell you anything about how light traces matter. It tells you how things scale between galaxies of one stellar mass and a different stellar mass. That's right. So the stellar mass follows the luminosity, and the characteristic velocity scales in a particular way. But that's unrelated to this plot. Okay, so what this means is, if we go back to the plot I had before, you try and say, what would I get if I did the obvious thing? I just took the dark matter objects and scaled them down with a constant efficiency for turning their baryons into stars, I can't reproduce this curve. What I get is something like this dashed line. So this dashed line is what you would get if you took the abundance of dark matter objects, assumed each one had the global fraction of baryons, so it had a representative fraction of baryons, and then was able to turn 30% of its baryons into stars. If you do that, then you find the two curves just touch here. That's where the 30% came from. So you'd match the observations at one point, which would happen to be close to the Milky Way, but you fail everywhere else. because the curves are just different shapes. So clearly, and you fail both at large masses, where in very big objects, the galaxies that form, they have far fewer stars than this would predict. But also for small galaxies, you fail. Except here. Well, you know, that's the success of the model. So you can make this more precise in the following way. You can say, well, let's assume, nevertheless, the observed galaxies do live in the observed dark matter objects, and in a sense, bigger galaxies form inside bigger dark matter objects, which seems reasonable. Then what you can do is you can use the observational data to give a precise measurement of the abundance of galaxies as a function of their stellar mass. How many galaxies are there per unit volume above a certain stellar mass, just the cumulative count. That's specified from the observational data I showed you. Now you go to the simulations, and you ask, how many dark matter objects are there per unit volume, which is well specified from a theoretical point of view, because the simulations allow you to find all the nonlinear dark matter objects which you believe could host a galaxy. There's a slight subtlety here. Let me just jump over this because it actually doesn't change the argument. So let's assume that the mass of a galaxy in stars, in other words, the amount of stars in a galaxy, is an increasing function of the mass of the dark halo it was born in. Okay, it seems reasonable. Bigger things should make bigger things. Then what you can do is just match these numbers. Because if you assume that the stellar mass of a galaxy is a monotonically increasing function of the mass of the object in which it's formed, you can match this observed number to this theoretical number and derive the required relationship between the mass of a galaxy and the mass of the dark matter object it was born in order for this to work. So you can say, if galaxies really formed in a cold dark matter universe, and the stellar mass of the galaxy was indeed monotonically increasing with the mass of the dark matter object it formed in, then you can predict what the halo mass should be associated with the given stellar mass. So here's So here's a curve to show you whether this is consistent with what you would get from other results. So this is now the stellar mass of the galaxy, 10 to the 10 times the mass of the Sun, 10 to 11.5, so the Milky Way is about here. And then this counting argument gives you this curve over this restricted range of masses. Okay? And then the symbols are other ways of measuring the dark matter halos around galaxies, observationally. The triangles here are measurements based on finding small galaxies orbiting around the big galaxies and using the motions statistically to infer the average mass of the big galaxies. So you take a few hundred galaxies of this mass, you find all the small objects orbiting around them, you stick them together, and you use their motions to get the average mass of a halo mass of an object with this stellar mass by looking at the motions of the small things around the big ones. That gives you this point. You look at galaxies of different masses, you get this series of points. So what you can see is certainly in the middle, it works reasonably well. The slope seems a bit flatter, but they're given the error bars and there may be systematics, I think it's not far off. The circles here are an independent way of doing this. You just, again, find a large sample of galaxies of a particular stellar mass, and then you look at gravitational lensing of objects behind them and use that to infer the total amount of material, dark and light, associated with those galaxies. And that gives you these symbols. And again, you get a consistent result. So you can see what this tells you is that this counting argument does end up assigning dark matter masses to the galaxies, which are of the same order, and depending on mass in a similar way to what you get just from this counting argument. So this is a... If you believe the model is right, but it does depend on the abundance of halos as a function of mass being what was predicted by the CDM model. It's very specifically. Whereas the observational measurements are just direct.
You just tuned your curve to give you the number of halos of a given stellar mass to be correct.
No, but I didn't tune it. No.
It was a free function.
No, it's not free at all. There were no free parameters in this. There's no free parameter in this curve.
You fit a function.
No.
To get your prediction.
No, you misunderstood the argument here.
Not in this, but in the previous.
No, this.
Bottom of the previous page.
Sorry, here.
Yeah, bottom of that.
This is a directly observed function.
Exactly.
This is a directly computed function.
Right, and you took the ratio.
No, this number is directly computed. Including the constant of proportionality.
Yeah, for the halo abundance.
Correct. So if I put these together. With no parameter, I get a unique relation between the halo mass and the stellar mass.
Well, you call it unique, but you've actually used up the whole function of observations in order to...
I haven't used the observations. The observations the observations had essentially no errors. That was...
You fit the observations.
No. I haven't fit them at all.
So...
This is not a fit. This is the directly observed quantity.
I know, but you've used them in making the next problem.
I understand, but what I've used... No, this is not a trivial point.
Okay.
This is a directly observed abundance of galaxies,
right,
which is just what you see on the sky.
Right.
This is a predicted abundance of dark matter as a function of their mass, which has used nothing, the observations. It's only, if you like, use the CMB. So these two functions have completely different sources. This relation is combining them with no additional parameters. Because this is a number per unit volume. So at a particular stellar mass like the mass of the Milky Way, there are...
you mean that's just one number?
No, this is a function. This is a directly observed function with units of per cubic megaparsec. This is a directly predicted function with units per cubic megaparsec. So I set those two numbers equal.
Right.
There's a unique function. With no...
And you say that predicts the halo mass for given stellar mass.
That's right. So the assumption is this one. There's a monotonic relation, but that's the only assumption.
Yeah, but it still seems to me that you are fitting...
No, there's no fit. No, I have to insist on that nothing has been fit.
Okay.
It's been... No, there is no fit. There's no function with adjusted parameters.
You're not predicting that
No.
You're assigning a halo mass to objects of the same abundance.
I'm assuming this ansatz. That's the assumption. So you find this plausible or not? But that's the only assumption. I mean, and in practice, you know, it's not plausible to be exact. Right. There must be some scatter in this relation. But
I mean, could you put it a little bit differently? We know the total mass in the universe of the dark matter. You've got to assign that mass to the galaxies in some way.
Oh, yes, but...
And you're assigning it.
No. The model assigns completely different. That's what this curve was, right?
Yeah.
There's an enormous difference between the model says...
So this
curve has an ansatz, but no adjusted parameters. That's why we take observations.
It's not a pure theoretical curve.
No, absolutely not. It's not a pure theoretical curve. That's true.
Right.
That's absolutely true. So what you've used is the observed abundance of objects. So this exactly. So this assumes this uses only the abundances of objects.
Right.
These points do not use the abundances of objects. They use direct measurements around the mass of the objects. So from that point of view, they're completely independent things. Here's a check on the consistency, because here I only used abundances of the objects. I didn't say anything about where they are. So now this relation tells me, for a given dark matter object, what mass galaxy should be in it. So now I can go to my simulation, find dark matter objects of each mass, and I know how many stars I should put in each. If I do this, I can work out the spatial clustering of the stars. This is now a prediction. So the observed spatial clustering of the points, this prediction, the two predictions of the lines, The difference is just the resolution of the simulation. So this is a zero-parameter prediction. So again, the fact that it works, it's not perfect, but it's still pretty good, is a confirmation of the validity of the underlying model.
When you say no free parameters, what parameters could you conceive of that would be in the way? Do you see what I mean?
Well, there are many ways you can decide to put galaxies into dark matter halos, but this particular recipe has specified it completely. So there were no additional parameters beyond the one I had before in order to fit the clustering. This was an external check.
But the model, it seems to me, the model is utterly implausible.
This may be true, but all I'm saying is that this was a zero parameter prediction, and these are observational data with their correct error bars.
But the model says that if I give you a halo of a certain mass, you can predict exactly what the stellar mass.
That's unlikely. First of all, I can quantify how much scatter we'd need to put on the relation to make a difference, which is interesting. Right. And I glossed over one detail, is the fact that you have galaxies living in clusters, and so you actually have to look at the internal structure, which has been done consistently, but it was...
What about gas-rich galaxies?
This is just using... Stars? A moment, this is just based on stars. So that's another interesting question, but I haven't addressed it. But what about it? You know, there's much less mass in galaxies in gas than in stars. So the stars are the dominant. If you take the material in galaxies in a representative volume of space, there are roughly 10 times as much material in stars as in gas.
So you have lower mass.
Yeah, very small galaxies goes the other way, but they're a tiny fraction of the mass. Yeah, that's correct. So this is what the relation looks like that is required to make this work. So here is the mass of the dark matter object. Here's the mass and stars of the galaxy that forms in it. And this curve is what's required to get everything to fit. And what you see is it's not a straight line. Right? But because those two distributions I started from were completely different shapes, you get a relation which is very nonlinear, even in log-log plot. There's a well-defined characteristic mass right about here, which corresponds to the mass of the Milky Way, actually. And when you go to very massive objects, you go to very massive dark matter objects, the mass of the galaxy in the center increases quite slowly, like roughly one-third power of the mass of the object. That's what's responsible for the sharp cutoff at the high mass end in the abundance of galaxies. As you go to lower mass objects, though, as you reduce the mass of the halo, the mass of the galaxy in the middle drops off very quickly. That's what's required to get the flat end of the galaxy max function to come out correctly. So it's because of the you had to take something which looked like a power law and bend it to give a characteristic scale. That's what's responsible for this. So apparently we have a very well-defined scale here. Okay, so now you can plot this in another way. You can go to halos of a given mass and ask for halo of each particular mass, what is the fraction of its baryons that have gone into stars? So that's what's shown here. This is the mass in stars divided the mass of the halo in which they formed, it's a function of the halo mass. So you see there's a very well-defined peak, which is near the knee of that function. It's about, corresponds roughly to the mass of the Milky Way's halo. And the peak value is up about here, which is just 3.5%. So even in the most efficient case, it's still relatively inefficient. And then the central galaxy is a very small fraction of the mass, both for big objects and for small objects.
Isn't there a contradiction there? There are 2-3.5% that have nothing to do with each other.
That's correct, yes.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different one.
What is the fraction of baryons?
So this is relation to the halo. So this is actually 20%. This is 20% of all the baryons here. Mm-hmm. So if you average this curve over all halos, you get 3.5% of the baryons. This is actually 20% of the baryons. So this is interesting because you may have heard people say they can carry out simulations and make nice simulated galaxies. Here's an example. I picked this one because it had the nicest picture. Right, so this really does look like a nice spiral galaxy with a bar in the middle and its edge on it. It looks great. But you look at where it falls on this plot. This is now the fraction of all the baryons in the stars in the middle. So this is the same curve, except I changed it to be normalized to baryon fraction. And even in the most efficient case, only about 20% of the baryons have made it into stars. The reason they got such a nice galaxy was 80% of the gas falling into stars. If you look at the simulations in the literature, there are essentially none which lie in this regime. And it's unfortunate, there's a very nasty anti-correlation. The ones which lie up here, like this one, and this one, and this one, all have very nice disks, and they look great. So they look nice, but they fail this. The ones that live down here, the reason they live down here is the galaxy formation was much more active. So the assumptions was that as the galaxy formed, lots of supernovae went off, and they blow a large fraction of the gas away. So the reason the efficiency is so small is because they've blown the 80% of the baryons back out again. The problem is if you blow 80% of the baryons out, you don't have any disk left. So the ones down here that fit this sun don't make things that look like nice spiral galaxies. So none of the detailed simulations actually produce things that look like real galaxies and satisfy this constraint. So there currently is still an open question.
But is that actually quantitative? Because like nice spiral doesn't sound like a very quantitative.
Well, no, particularly when you realize, you know, there's a lot of image processing goes on to make these things, so that makes it even less quantitative. So, went the wrong way there. It gets even worse if you look at small galaxies, and you can see why, of course, because here, if you go down to the things that small galaxies, this curve is going down really fast in order to suppress the number of small objects. And so actually the simulations that are out there for small galaxies typically do even worse. Now this is a logarithmic plot vertically, so you can actually see the curve. So these are simulations of dwarf galaxies, including my own. This is what's needed to get the count of objects to come out right. You know, the efficiencies are off by orders of magnitude. So this doesn't really work yet. I mean, fine. You can make a model which does this, but it doesn't look like the simulations that people are currently running. Because effectively, you need a very small number of stars to form and blow the rest of the baryons away in order to get such a low efficiency. And although these simulations do blow baryons away, they don't do it efficiently enough. People doing simulations nowadays like to simulate things at redshifts 2. There are two reasons for that. Redshift 2 is only 3 gig years after, or 4 gig years after the beginning of the universe, instead of 13, so you only have to run your simulation for a third of the time. So with a given amount of computer time, you can run a much nicer simulation. That's one reason. The other thing is, although there are now lots of observations of galaxies at redshift 2, we really can't see them as well as we can see the nearby ones. So it's much easier to convince yourself that you fit the data at redshift 2 than redshift 0. So there are lots of, I'd say, more than half of all the work in the galaxy formation at the moment is simulating redshift 2 galaxies, because it's all very hot and you can convince yourself it's great. But actually, from this particular point of view, the situation is worse. So this is the curve I just showed you, central stellar mass over halo mass. This is what you get for redshift 2 galaxies if you do the same counting argument. And it appears to maximize now at 10% instead of 20%. So actually, that's because although they do find massive galaxies at high redshift, there are not that many of them. Whereas the number of density of halos has actually not changed that much. So when you do this matching, the formation efficiency is less efficient at redshift 2 by about a factor of 2 than today. So now you have to form with 10% efficiency. Whereas if you look at the simulations, almost all of them form with 90% efficiency. So it's worse.
Are the mass measurements reliable at redshift
2? No. I mean, people argue about them at redshift 0, so therefore you can figure at redshift 2 they're worse.
So if you do it at all redshifts, is there a redshift where
I think this is the sum totality of the data, right? So this was the redshift 0 one that I showed you before, peaking around the 20%. They've normalized in a different way, but this is 20% of the way I had it done before. Oh, it's over here. It's this axis. Here's 20%. And these are redshifts 1 and 2. So 1 and 2 are both look a lot lower than here. You know, this could be that they can't determine the masses at redshift 2, so I'm not convinced really this is right. But at the moment, if you take the data at face value, it's even worse at redshift 2 than at redshift 0. Okay. So I want to now move on to actual model building to fit the galaxy population. So I don't think the reason I've been laying into the simulations is that, you know, these are simulations where people have attempted to make single galaxies, and they're not close. So this means, you know, trying to make a representative sample of galaxies and representative volume of the universe is a much worse problem, right? Because the amount of resolution, the amount of computational resources you can put on each object is much smaller. So if not yet close for individual objects, we're very far away from doing this in a representative volume of space. So if you want to model making the galaxy population, you have to take a different route. So that's what's typically called semi-analytic galaxy modeling. And the game here is to stick as close as you can to the background cosmological model. So it's specifically trying to make models for the galaxy population in this cosmology. But then to try in that context to maintain physical consistency, like conservation of mass and conservation of energy, but otherwise to be quite flexible by saying we don't understand in detail how any of the individual processes work, and try and see how far you can get by simple measurements of things like clustering and abundances. So you begin with things that you can measure well, like the abundance of galaxies as a function of their luminosity or mass, or the fraction of galaxies which are central galaxies of the dark matter halos as opposed to things which are satellites orbiting around them. Those are things that are directly observationally accessible. You use the spatial distribution because that's something which the theory does predict, so it gives you extra constraints. And you use the fact that in the dark matter, in the cosmology, we understand how individual objects are assembled, at least the dark matter parts. So therefore, if you make a model for how to populate the dark matter objects with galaxies, you can ask how the galaxies at redshift 2, for example, will move, how they may merge together, how they could be related to the galaxies at redshift 0. And then I think the best you can say for what you do then is you use physically plausible recipes. So this is pure phenomenology at this point. So you know, for example, that gas has to cool off to make stars in the middle of a dark matter halo. So if the cooling time is long, you'll make fewer stars. You can't cool off more gas than you've got. But beyond that, there's a lot of freedom. So you make a simple recipe and see how far you can get. Similarly, we don't understand star formation. You know the gas has to cool off and get dense, but then the efficiency, we don't understand. So again, you assume it scales in some simple way with the properties of the system and see how far you can get. How do you constrain these? Well, you have to use the observational phenomenology as far as possible to constrain things. And where we do have detailed simulations, you can try and use them to build your intuition about what sort of recipes would be plausible. But you have to still live with a lot of uncertainty, because clearly your treatment of these things, well, it's not fundamental physics in the sense that people would understand it here, and even if you could do the simulation in detail, but it's even less fundamental physics doing it this way. So the tricky thing when you take this approach to modeling is to try and hunt on to separate things which are part of your initial hypothesis, which are things which actually attest. So that's why I had this dispute with Neil, because I think, you know, if you can't separate that, then you're lost. So this is why this is the most important thing. So, for example, typically what we can do is we can try and set the recipes on the properties of individual objects, like their abundances and their internal properties, and then use as a test the clustering. Or the redshift evolution. We can set all the properties at redshift A and then ask, can we get the right answer at redshift 2? Of course, when it doesn't work, then you tune your recipes. But, you know, people are always tuning their physical theories, even in fundamental physics, so I don't feel bad about that. So what I'm going to talk about now are more detailed modeling based on the Millennium simulations. So this is the original simulation published in 2005. This just zooms on the dark matter distribution, so I'm sure you've seen pictures of this before. So this is just the dark matter distribution predicted by our standard cosmology at redshift 0 on three different scales. From this, by employing these recipes, we can now identify all the dark matter objects in the simulation and their histories, put these recipes on top, calculate forwards from the beginning, so you then get a simulation of the galaxy population in this whole volume. The advantage of doing this is now you have a galaxy population. You can imagine observing it in exactly the same configuration you would observe the real universe, so you can compare with data like these. So these are real data from the 2DF survey and at different scales, from the Sloan survey, and this one old survey from Center for Astrophysics. And then in the virtual universe, you can survey a calculation in the same way to get a virtual observation for the 2DF, the Great CFA survey over the Sloan, and then you can compare the statistical properties in the observational plane. So clearly you can do a visual comparison to see if the texture and the visual properties of the structure look similar, and then you can make quantitative statistics to measure whether the clustering properties do in fact agree. And as you could see from the plot I showed you earlier, visually here, in fact, the agreement is quite good. It's not perfect, but it's quite good. Because you have a simulation of the entire distribution, you can actually simulate the observation not just locally, but looking back in time. So this is actually a simulated light cone, looking back through such a simulation where we're here. This is redshift 1. This is redshift 2. This is redshift 3. Now, it's just looking back, because, of course, in real life, as you look back in distance, you look back in time. So now, with this, since you've simulated the entire evolution to the present, you can actually, in the simulation, make a light cone of this kind. So, you know, from a theoretical point of view, most theorists think this is crap. But most observers love it because they can actually compare it with real observations. And the things that the theorists do, they can't. So the result is, actually, this was finished in 2005. We've been trying to keep track of people who've used these data. There are already well over almost 400 papers published which have used the numerical data from this simulation. Why? It's because that's the best you can get if you actually really want to compare with real observations. The other things are not there yet. So, you know, you do what you can. And interestingly, also, one thing we discovered here is if you have this kind of data, it's important to make them public in a way that other people can actually access them. So another reason why this was successful is all these data are put on queryable databases that are absolutely open to everybody. So most of these 370 papers, the last time I looked, are actually by people who are entirely unassociated with the group that actually carried the simulations out. Nevertheless, you know, it was the best we could do at the time, but it's quite limited. It's limited because the simulation was only 500 megaparsecs on a side. Now, 500 megaparsecs sounds like a big region, particularly if you want to simulate all the galaxies in it. But actually, it's a lot smaller than the surveys that people are now undertaking. In particular, it's too small to be able to measure the baryon acoustic oscillation feature that people want to use to study the expansion of the universe. So it's too small for the surveys that people want to do for precision cosmology. On the other hand, it's also too big. And that's because, you know, in this volume, you can only have a finite number of particles in your simulation. It was 10 to the 10 in that particular simulation. That means there's the smallest object you can resolve. And that object, the dark matter object at this time, the smallest dark matter object you can resolve is much bigger than the dark matter object you think would host a dwarf galaxy. So the Millennium simulation didn't have enough resolution to model the dwarf galaxy population. There were no convergence tests to test, you know, which of the results that came out of this simulation were actually a result of the recipes we put in and which were just due to numerical limitations, because we just had one simulation. We did it in 2005, and people have changed their minds about what they think the cosmological parameters are, so it now has the wrong cosmological parameters for today. It's about 2 sigma off from today's best cosmological parameters. And the other thing which people really don't like is they have to believe us because they can't run it again themselves. You know, and one of the things in physics is you want to be able to calculate yourself and see if you agree with what the people wrote because you don't always trust they did it right or they were honest or whatever. If you would like to get to a situation where other people can test this, change the simple recipes we used, change the cosmology, see how things depend on it. This was not possible. So we've been trying to address these problems one by one. So the first thing we did was run another simulation with 100 times better resolution. We couldn't put in more particles, so we had to make the region smaller. So this was a fifth the linear size, so that gives you 125 times better mass resolution for the same number of objects. And then we matched the two simulations, had the same outputs, the same cosmology and everything. So this allows us at least to carry out now resolution tests to see if you improve your resolution by a factor of 100, do you actually get the same properties for the galaxies, statistically?
Did you actually take a region out or a bigger symbol?
No, because it had to be periodic, so it's independent. So here's a test. So this is the mass function I showed you before, observations, extended here with some other observations of bigger error bars, which are from somebody else, still from the Sloan survey. This was the mass function from the original Millennium simulation. Now you run the same galaxy formation model on the higher resolution simulation, you get this green line. So you can see they work down to about here, and then this one just drops down, and that's because it doesn't have enough resolution to see the small dark matter objects where these dwarfs are forming. So you can see that effectively the resolution was okay down to a stellar mass about 10 times smaller than the Milky Way, and then it wasn't good enough to look at the dwarfs.
Even at the high end, it's overproducing. I agree, not as badly as the other thing, but it's still...
Well, don't forget, here it's an issue because these objects are not very common, so then the volume of the higher resolution simulation isn't big enough, so part of this can be statistics.
So I shouldn't worry too much about that.
No. Anyway, you shouldn't. Well, in this game, you shouldn't worry about anything which only differs by this much. You only worry about things that differ
well,
by this much.
Well, that's obviously worse.
So how do you fit the parameters of this galaxy formation model?
They were tuned to fit the mass function, but this was before these data came out. So another thing you can see is it doesn't fit the data.
So they're
better data.
Independent. So the errors were bigger, it used to fit the data.
Yeah, the data, at the time they made this model, they weren't concentrating on this aspect as much, and they didn't try to fit these low mass objects. They concentrated on the high mass end.
Yeah. But in principle, you can change the parameters to fit them.
Right, so of course, we'll get there. So now, having this, we can now make new galaxy formation models. So the idea is to implement the modeling both simultaneously on both simulations, so you can actually test which things are converged and which are not. Extend the properties then down to lower mass objects, since we now have a simulation where you can see the lower mass objects. To improve things so they fit the new data, that means tune. And to test against the clustering, which hadn't been done before. So I'll show you the things that work well first. It's always good to show the good things and then show the bad things. I'm aiming for 3. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
So this is what the mass function looks like after we've tuned the parameters again. Now we were actually trying to fit this data, so now, of course, it looks okay. So now we have a model still a bit high over here because here the good curve is the red one. So it's still not there. But this, I think, could be a measurement problem. That's another story. But now it fits down of about 5 orders of magnitude. So you can find physically plausible parameters in these recipes which don't violate anything obvious and do fit the data. So that's kind of an existence proof. It doesn't prove it's the right model, but at least you can get a roughly plausible model that fits.
So are you going to tell us what the primary parameters that got in there are?
I can. I wasn't, but it's a reasonable comment, so let me ask. So you saw... We had to start off with a curve which looks like this. We put in just gas cooling, right? That had nothing. Gas cooling is inefficient in very massive objects because they're very hot. So if you put in gas cooling, you get something which is just as steep at this end and bends down like this. You get a bend in roughly the right place, but it's not nearly as steep as this. Now we put in the effects of supernovae and stellar feedback. That puts energy back when you form stars. And that can blow gas out of small objects because they have weak potential wells and the binding energy is low. That's what pulls this end down. But that doesn't produce this. That's still enough. So up here, you still need something else to suppress the high mass objects.
Right, I understand that. But even when you're doing that on the lower end, you now get the efficiencies that you need?
Oh, yeah, by construction now. Right, basically. What this means is we didn't do a simulation, but we know with a certain number of stars you can only get a certain amount of energy back. That amount of energy is enough if you use it efficiently to blow the stuff out.
Okay, and are you making any assumptions about the IMF that are strained?
This is normal IMF, yeah. Okay. But what it means is down here at the low mass end, you know, we're basically using all the supernova energy pretty much to blow stuff out.
So you're assuming that supernovae couple at 100%?
Roughly, yeah. We're close.
That's tough, right?
That's tough, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you said when you pull that left end down, the right goes up again. So
yeah, yeah, right, that's right. So now we put in the cooling and the supernova feedback, you get a curve which goes like this and comes over here.
So
basically that says in galaxy clusters, we're still cooling off much too much gas in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, this is an old observational problem, why aren't there cooling flows in galaxy clusters? So the models assume there's an AGN at the center, and this is pumping out energy in massive objects. And that's what's cut the end. So that's the modeling that's been put in. So you need a separate process to cut off things in the massive objects.
And that's AGM.
Well, it's, yeah, we claim it's AGM. We don't know, of course, but what you know is you need another process which basically switches off the cooling and star formation in the high mass objects.
You just stick that in to get it to...
Well, we put it in a plausible way, yeah, and then just check that this is what comes out.
But also, what about the abundances at the low mass end? Do you recover the proper abundances for the...
Yeah, this is the abundance, right? This is the
metallic abundances.
I might have that plot. I'll show you.
Okay.
Yeah, they do come out, actually. This just shows you that if you get the stellar mass function, then the abundance function of light comes out okay as well. These are the various luminosity functions in the Sloan survey. An interesting thing is in the high-resolution simulation, you can go find all the galaxies that have it look like the Milky Way. They're predicted to be disk galaxies with the right stellar mass, and then count small objects around them. And that's what's shown here. So this is the abundance as a function of luminosity. These are extremely faint objects. These are very faint objects. These are faint objects. And these are the ones that we got before. So this is, you know, the Milky Way is actually, its brightness is off the plot. This is magnitudes. You know, so physicists can switch off. But this is the log of the luminosity. The Milky Way is over here, and this is 100 times less than the Milky Way, and this is 10 to the 4 times less than the Milky Way in luminosity. So the observations of the red curve here, plus this point, and the predictions in the simulations for our preferred model were this one. So this is the median of a few thousand Milky Way-like objects, and this is the 10 and 90% points of the scatter amongst them. So you can see it's okay for most of the range. It's maybe a little bit high, but not too far off. I mean, there are big observational error bars on this faint end as well.
So where did those points come from?
This is counting objects around the Milky Way. Those are the very faint dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way. And the ones down here are the ones that people call the classical dwarfs, and these are what they call the ultra-faint dwarfs. That's the colors. Let me skip that. Here's the metallicity. These are scaling relations. This is gas phase metallicity. For the simulation, is the points. This is a fit to the Sloan data from Tremonti et al. And these are points for local dwarf galaxies. What this is there is the abundance of heavy elements in the gas in the galaxies. That's what's produced by the stars. And this is a logarithmic scale, so there's about a factor of 30 between here and here. The abundance of the heavy elements.
See, what I'm worried about is that if you need 100% coupling, that's a big problem because the coupling is probably a lot lower than that. And if you're going to get around that, you're going to have to put in a steeper IMF, and that's going to throw it out.
Well, we're not there yet. I mean, this was basically a standard chemical evolution model, so. No, it's not exactly 100%, so there's enough left over that it worked out okay.
I mean, it's good that it,
yeah, yeah. This is the Tully-Fisher relation. This is what you were saying. So this is the rotation speed of a galaxy. This is its brightness. This is the faint galaxy. These are the bright ones. These are bright spirals. These are dwarf galaxies. And the points here are what the simulation says. So you can see this. It looks like there's more curvature in the simulation than this, whereas this is pretty close to a straight line. But given the error bars, it's not too critical yet.
Lambda CDM, it doesn't produce Tully-Fisher, so to speak.
This is what it produces. So if you think that's inside the error bars, it has produced Tully-Fisher.
No, but this is my construction.
You put in by hand.
No, no, this is circular.
It's not a prediction.
How did you get the masses when you calibrated stellar mass, total mass?
Stellar mass comes from the luminosity in the stellar populations. There's no dynamics.
That's true, but then there was a consistency that you showed. The first consistency that you showed, there were velocities used in it, right?
No. So. Well, that was satellite velocities at 100 kiloparsecs. It's nothing to do with the stuff inside the galaxy.
So you said this is 10 kiloparsecs, that's 100 kiloparsecs.
I mean, there are relations, but there's not used directly. You know, it's not a great fit, but it's still, could be worse.
There's a paper's just been published in Physical New Letters by McGough.
Yeah, I know about that.
Put in the Lander CDM.
Well, no, he didn't put in the Lander CDM. He did not. I actually sent him, if he'd taken the trouble to go to our public database and just download the data and put them on top, they actually lie fairly close to his points. They're not exactly on top, but they're close. The line you put in there had nothing to do with Lander CDM predictions.
He's plotting flat rotation curves and lost his addresses.
No, what he put in for the map, baryon mass was just omega times the halo mass. And as I showed you, that's not what the model requires. Here's the clustering. I'm showing you the massive galaxies. So this is galaxies 10 times as massive as the Milky Way, twice as massive as the Milky Way. The data, the symbols, the curves, the prediction. The two different curves here are predictions for the two different simulations. This mass is perfectly converged. Works very nicely. That's another version of the plot I showed you before. I think I'm going to skip through these. This is trying to show you it works for individual clusters, but I don't have time. This was to show you it works for high redshift galaxies. I won't have time. So the point here was just to show that if you go to a light cone, you can now pick the high redshift galaxies the same way as the observers do by their magnitudes and colors on the sky. And they can ask, if I pick them this way, do I get the same distribution of redshifts? Do I get the same number of objects? Do I get the same masses for the objects? And you know, there are big uncertainties in these conversion factors, but basically here, for example, is the different colored curves here. The dashed curves are observational data picked by color and magnitude on the sky, and then people have gone and got the redshifts. And they pick the colors in such a way to get high redshift objects. So you take this red histogram, for example, which is using Lyman break. It picked galaxies typically at redshift 2. And the black histogram here picked galaxies typically at redshift 3, different color cuts. You do the same thing to the mock catalog, plot what you get these solid histograms. So you can see they're peaked in the same place. And there's no adjustment, the vertical axis is the actual number on the sky. So again, it's not perfect, but it's actually quite close. Let me go on to the things that don't work so well. It's what happens if you look at the clustering at lower masses. I showed you these two before. These two don't look so good. And this is now slightly less massive than the Milky Way, and about 10 times less massive than the Milky Way. They're still fairly close on large scales. The clustering is predicted to be too strong on small scales. And again, notice that two different simulations agree with each other. This is not a problem with the simulation. It's the model itself is not predicting the right answer. This is the history. This is supposed to be the cosmic star formation history. The number of stars forming per unit volume is a function of time. And the symbols are the observations. An interesting property of the observations, if you put a smooth curve through these observations and integrate the total formation of stars from the beginning to the present day, you don't actually end up with the present day density of stars. And this is a purely observational problem of some kind, either in measuring the masses of stars today or the star formation rate somewhere in history. So it's difficult when you're a theorist to know which of the data sets you want to try and model because they're not consistent with each other. But anyway, if you take this kind of looks flat over this whole redshift range, whereas the model prediction clearly peaks at redshift 3, so it looks like the star formation is too early. And things look worse. Let's get that. If you look, now this is again, the abundance of galaxies is a function of their mass, but now split in redshifts. So I showed you redshift 0, and I showed you different data. This curve fit extremely well. So it still fits with this restricted data set. Now with these data, you can see, for example, here at redshift 1, this is the abundance of galaxies per unit volume as a function of their stellar mass. This is the model prediction. The model prediction here says that this stellar mass, about 10 to the 10, actually this abundance is pretty much what it was at redshift 0. They haven't changed much. That's because they basically were already formed. Whereas the observational data have gone down by a factor of 3. In the observations, there aren't as many galaxies of that mass at redshift 1 as there are at redshift 0. And that's not consistent, and it gets worse. And probably this somewhere about here, redshift 2 is the last one where it's reason, the error bars are reasonably small on the observations. You can see it's almost a factor of 10. So apparently in the real universe, the small galaxies formed later than they did in the simulation. So what I want to show you is that from the statistical point of view, we can do precision modeling. What that means is, given a model, we can predict its statistical consequences with small error bars, because the volumes are large enough. Because the uncertainty is that the physics has been put on an extremely schematic way, and it's probably incorrect in many of its details. But that, of course, is what we're trying to find out. If you want to try and test models, you should address the abundance of the objects and their scaling relations, like the Tully-Fisher and others, or the Medalist derivations, and their clustering and their evolution. If you have observational data from all these things, if you want to try and understand the physics and sort of box it into a smaller range, then you have to use all these kinds of data. It seems to get something which is viable, we need strong feedback, presumably from supernovae at low masses, and also at high masses, probably from the AGN. I think the clustering problem that I showed you, the one with the small-scale clustering being too strong for low-mass galaxies, is something to do with the cosmology, in fact. But I don't have time to show you that. The current models, the star formation clearly occurs too early, particularly in the low-mass objects. It's okay for the massive objects, which come out more or less where they should, but the small-mass objects are supposed to go away by the time you get to redshifts 1 and 2, and they don't in the simulations because they formed quite early. So I think probably we do need to change the cosmology in order to fix this. We've done this now. But we also clearly need a better understanding of the star formation processes, because the way it's being treated at the moment is not getting the sequence of star formation in different kinds of galaxies to come out correctly. Okay, I'll stop there.
Is this downsizing, or is it something?
Yeah, it is. There is downsizing in the model, but it's a lot weaker than in the real data.
Okay.
So that was essentially here. I mean, if I plotted the green curve here, on top of the green curve here, it is lower. So you know, there are fewer small galaxies there, so it does downsize, but not as much as this observational data.
So do you think that's more an issue with the cosmology?
No, it's not the cosmology.
Or is it just the variant physics?
I can show you it's not the cosmology, but I didn't have time because that was the next few things. There were things that came after this about how to deal with other cosmologies. But
maybe you can just show that. Just that next. All right,
so I'm not going to explain any of this. I'm just going to show you what was there. So we actually have a scheme which, because the main point is, you know, people say we don't know what the cosmology is. But, you know, for people who work on galaxy formation, we really do know it well enough. Yeah. And so any of the cosmologies people talk about are really quite close. I mean, as long as it's lambda CDM, so we're only changing the parameters, are quite close to the one we already run. So we can ask, we don't really have to run another simulation. Can't we just be smart and scale the one we've got in some way to get it to represent the other cosmologies? And the answer is, if you're careful, yes, you can. You can represent the other cosmologies, for example, WMAP 3 or WMAP 7, at kind of 1% level for the dark matter statistics, just by scaling the one we've got. So rather than spending time on doing more simulations, that's what we decided to do. So this actually does show some parameters. So if you go from WMAP 1 to WMAP 7, the main parameter change is the drop in the amplitude. The fluctuations are weaker. Turns out that you can compensate for that. Looks big when you write it this way. It isn't that big. And we can compensate that by relatively small changes in these various efficiency parameters. So the two models here, the thin and the thick one of each color, are WMAP 3 and WMAP 7. And basically, except here where this is a resolution question, in the main part of the curves, the thick and the thin models are really close to each other. And this means in the two different cosmologies, you can basically represent the data equally well with small shifts in the parameters. So for example, a star formation efficiency parameter changed by 20%. Supernova feedback parameter changed by 30%. AGN feedback parameter changed by a factor of 2. That's just shifting the bright and fade end. So relatively small parameter changes. You know, we don't have a priori reasons for any of these numbers. They were just fitting parameters, and they're still in the physical ranges, so that's no problem. The luminosity functions then fit fine. They look equivalent. The interesting thing is the clustering. So WMAP1 is now red, WMAP7 is green. So these are too noisy, but look at these ones, which were the ones that went before. You can see there is an improvement, red to green. Still isn't really fitting. Closer here, massive end, it worked fine. So we didn't get rid of all the problem. It helped, but it wasn't enough. And if you go on to the other things that didn't fit, makes the stars form later. You can see the green curve has shifted to the left. But this particular problem about the downsizing really didn't help at all. I think here you have to show, it's difficult to see here, but it's actually the dotted curves and the solid curves. So this thin, you can barely see here in this one, that was the effect of the cosmology. So it did help a bit. You know, compared to how far off we are, it's nothing. So this points out that the cosmological effects, cosmological effects are really very small compared to the effects of the galaxy formation physics and all this stuff. So,
there's supposedly always been a problem with dark matter to fit low surface brightness galaxies. And this is reflected in the long mass objects you fit in.
I think, I can't remember how far, I did have a plot which was relevant for that further back here. The one which showed the scaling relations. You can see that I spent a lot more longer than usual, first part of this talk to explain all these simple counting arguments, because, you know, for the people who aren't astronomers, those are the most interesting ones. That's why I ran out of the second half. But this is the size. So this is the predicted. This is the measurements of size and the Sloan down to 10 to 9.5. So it's not yet down to the really low mass. And these are the predicted sizes. So recently with the new models, we did check further down, and it continues to fit fairly well. So if you buy the inefficiency, I mean, the issue is that stuff has to be very efficient, then the size actually is okay. So the real issue is, you know, is the efficiency that's required, if you like, the inefficiency which is required to get such a small number of stars, is that plausible?
Yeah, there seems to be a rebellion forming in France and Germany with regards to dark matter. Two conferences in Paris on warm dark matter. There are statements in their conferences about issues that the post of the time proceeding doesn't work.
Warm dark matter doesn't work?
Cold dark matter.
Everybody who wants an alternative theory says the cold dark matter doesn't work. That's how they justify themselves, as I think you know.
But KEV is now very popular. And besides, we don't. Xenon 100 is coming out shortly. Mm-hmm. From what I gather, they don't see anything.
Well, I think. Well, the
this doesn't mean to say I'm right. However, in the event that they don't see the events around GEVs, what is your opinion about that?
Well, I think this is the thing which is most affected, because these are the things I showed you. These are the smallest ones, right? These are the dwarf satellites of the Milky Way. So this would be the place where, of the things I showed, would be most affected by putting in a warm dark matter cutoff. And, you know, it is true, even though this was our favored model, and, you know, they're not hugely more, but there are definitely more objects there, so could help. For most of the things for the more massive galaxies, then the warm dark matter option doesn't make a difference. The other place where it makes a difference is for the Lyman alpha forest predictions, so that's but also is an interesting point.
What about the cosmology?
Well, that's where the... it depends who's doing the analysis, but at the moment, the strongest constraints on the mass of the warm dark matter, the published ones, come from the Lyman alpha forest measurement.
What about the cosmology? Because for years, you couldn't use hot warm dark matter to just cluster well enough.
Hot dark matter doesn't work. Warm dark matter is fine.
It's okay.
Warm is the same as cold.
Yeah, the warm only affects.
It's not that warm.
Yeah, yes, yes, no, exactly. It really only affects these little guys.
It's a low surface.
Yeah, the very low surface brights or the very dwarf galaxies.
More questions, Herr Simon.
The discrepancy that you show in the abundance of galaxies at the low mass end, because there is still some. Is that significant? And
there's also which one?
The less massive ones.
At
five redshift? No, at redshift zero. So just the abundance of galaxies, the luminosity functions.
The luminosity functions are actually under-predicting. These are the observations, right?
Okay, that you're putting the
mind there. This is a curious thing, right? Because you're right. If you look at the previous plot,
it looks
slightly high.
Yeah.
But so it depends, you know, is it the masses? It's not, there's the differences are not very big, but there's a subtle point here, so it depends which of these you concentrate on.
Mm-hmm. If you use a stellar mass or magnitude, you get a different answer.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. These are photometry, and these are small effects, so it's in conversion between light and mass, and the stellar mass models and so on.
So the one that you see in the mass, you go back. So
not very big, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you take these at face value, there's probably a systematic error bar on this.
The part that is 10 to the 8 or so, that little thing, yeah. Is that significant, really, or
no?
No.
I'm not convinced that, you know, of all the system. I mean, you do your best with the systematic errors, but there are always some left.
So you mentioned that when you integrate up the Madal plot, you don't match the present day stellar mass of galaxies. How far off is that?
Well, if you just take the star formation rate as the rate of stars per unit volume, you integrate that, you're off by about a factor of 3. But that's not correct, because actually some of them are, because stars evolve.
Yes.
So when you take out the fact that some of the stars evolve, then you're off by a bit less than a factor of 2, I think. Do you remember that, Mike?
Yeah.
Is it higher or lower?
It's lower.
It's lower.
The star formation rates seem too high. That's why when you look at the model, because the models obviously enforce this particular constraint. So that's when you look at it. Whenever I get there.
Could there be like a selection effect and you tend to see places where it's easy to see?
The model by definition enforces this constraint. And you can see it looks low compared to the points.
Could there be a selection effect and you tend to do these measurements where there is more star formation? I don't know.
It's probably the calibration of the indicators. You know, you don't really measure star formation rates. You measure emission line luminosities, and you have to convert the two from one to the other.
Okay, so if there is no more questions for Simon, so Simon will be here until tomorrow afternoon. He will give the colloquium tomorrow at 2. Let's talk again.